This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I was part of the morning workshop, and I'd like to bring some remarks from the morning to... My name is Orkan Talhan. I'm a professor of fine arts in Penn, University of Pennsylvania. And I was part of the workshop in the morning, and the organizers kindly asked me to bring some of the discussions into the evening session so that we can really start thinking all together, connect these events with each other so that we can start thinking about all these subject matter together. I think it was a very interesting session in the morning where we had many different voices. We discussed about adjustment and evasion from a multitude of voices, which were from architecture, from design, from practitioners, from artists, and people who really see adjustment and evasion in very different perspectives. A couple of points that I like to bring up is, for example, we start to think about the time scale of adjustment. What does it mean to adjust for today? What does it mean to adjust tomorrow? What is the time scale? When you look up, when we zoom out in our lives, when do we adjust? To whom do we adjust? What are today's things that we need to adjust? What are tomorrow's things to adjust? Before moralizing what we need to adjust for, how can we think about adjustments in different time scales? That was one way to look at the issue. Eduardo Cadava brought, a very interesting perspective on the role of language and how we speak somebody else's language that exists before us. And of course, through our lives, we adjust to that language and customize it and identify ourselves with that language, and becomes our sole mode of expression, our existence through language. That's the primary mode of adjustment to somebody else's language. And of course, the role of literature and the way language manifests itself in literature. He gave a couple of good examples from Paul Celan and Benjamin about reading history, because history is very important in terms of understanding the consequences, understanding the current conditions that we need to adjust. So without understanding what the history brought us, we cannot really adjust today, because that's, without understanding the past, it's really difficult what we are going to adjust for. So reading creatively history is one form of adjustment that will inform future activities. We discussed a couple of different perspectives on the role of design, spatial, architecture especially, and the role of the consequences of adjustment and evasion as physical manifestations or design manifestations, and role of the architects. And we will hear Lebius Wood's remarks on the role of radicality and revolution in architecture, and how we have to think about the notions of breaking away from existing paradigms through design, through architecture. And you will see, you may agree or disagree with his remarks, but that's one way of looking at the role of design in understanding the role of evasion. And I think for me, one of the most interesting parts was to think about to evade or to adjust together. So we can endlessly, in our solidarity, adjust to our own lives, to our own practices, and on our own being. But what does it mean to be in a room like this and have events like this? So we start thinking about adjusting together. What is the ideology behind this? How can we arrive to different things? And we are living in times where we are inventing new ways to come together, in terms of the Occupy movement or in different ways. But we are in a place to think about together, how do we adjust or how do we resist together? And, as Aaron opened it up, what does it mean to imagine together different forms of adjustment and different forms of radical adjustment? And I think we can all now together start to think more about these things in an open discussion. So I will pass it along to...
Hello? Hello? Is this close enough? My name is Todd Rohi. I'm speaking on behalf of Common Room, which includes architects Lars Fischer, Maria Ibanez, myself, and sometimes the graphic designer Jeff Hahn. We are an architectural practice, an exhibition space, a publishing imprint, a collaborative production platform, and we're based in New York City and Brussels. What I'm going to read is an excerpt from a conversation that was transcribed in Costco Issues 12, Generous Structures. And it's a dialogue between the editors of Costco Issue 12, Bina Choi and Axel Vieder. And it includes Ifau and Jesko Fezzer, which is a Berlin-based collaboration and Common Room. So here's the excerpt. Bina Choi and Axel Vieder. One of the many interesting echoes between the work of Common Room and Ifau and Jesko Fezzer is the emphasis you both place on incompleteness or openness, in parentheses, never finish, in building practice. It seems to us to have a curiously ambivalent status. On the one hand, as architects, you limit your control by giving space for the inhabitants and users to work things out on their own. On the other hand, your approach is not about a refusal of interventions, rather you define certain parameters. It almost feels like a game in which rules are established by the architects as masters of the game so that people can start to play. Would you agree? Common Room. We can understand the master of the game in two ways. Firstly, as someone who sets up and defines the game and its rules and controls the play, acting as the authority, or secondly, as someone who is an expert at playing the game. Referring to the first meaning, we establish rules for the game and these define boundaries within which to play, but these rules do not provide a full definition of what is possible. The rules may allow for potential misinterpretation or misuse. We are the authority only as much as we state the rules but choose not to control the play beyond that. In reference to the second understanding, we hope we play the game well, but only as well as the other users and players. There is always a set of rules, but they are not always identified. The five obstructions for architecture that have informed our practice and collaboration were identified somewhat retrospectively, a reflection on the shared principles that seemed to shape the first few years of our practice. The five obstructions for architecture outline challenges to our creative process. They are provocations for Common Room as an architectural practice and the discipline of architecture in general. And the five obstructions are appropriate the everyday, which means pay attention, elevate the ordinary. Obstruction number two is share space, negotiate, sequence, overlap groups and events. Obstruction number three is include difference. Be inclusive. Adjust conventional spatial and cultural boundaries. Obstruction number four, don't be new. Don't be new for the sake of the new. Oftentimes what a project needs is already within the definition or context. And obstruction number five is never finish. Making and using architecture are an interconnected process.
So I'm Vajanti Rao, and I'm an anthropologist. But I'm also an anthropologist who studies cities. So I guess what I'm going to speak, I just have something very small that I want to present to you as my concept of evasion. My friend Alexandra just asked me what my understanding was, and I very much agree with Ellen Sixu's provocation to think about evasion as escape, but a very constrained form of escape. So let me show an image which can't be projected, so it has to be seen on my my laptop, which I can pass around. So this is an image of a kind of a community space, which is very, well, it has barely any walls, but it has a structure. It has, it has the outlines of a structure. And it's a space which is found at the end of a long row of shacks, which adjoin or which are at the border of the biggest garbage dump in Mumbai. Actually, in fact, the only garbage dump. And this is where, this is where the rag pickers live. As in many parts of the world, this kind of practice where people become part of the infrastructure, particularly around garbage and waste, is very, very common in most cities. In fact, where everything is not that mechanized. They are, in fact, very, very important to keeping the space alive. So within my discipline or within social sciences in general, I would say that the peculiarity of researching these kinds of situation actually lies in this blurring of boundaries between acts of research and acts of design, or acts of design, designing means of participation, in fact. And also blurring a line between research and its translation into acts of renovation. So we all, as researchers, would surely agree that these are the kinds of situations that call for complete renovation, erasure, and repair. So research itself, in other words, is calling out to become a part of this circuit of breakdown, repair, renovation that actually characterizes cities like Mumbai. In particular, research on these sorts of cities has become entwined with policy making. And therefore, the boundaries between observation and participation, between critical distance and ethical expertise, are constantly breaking down. So these boundaries are actually becoming very evasive, to use your terms. In such a context, scholarship, which thinks through this relationship between participation and expertise, is particularly critical. Because these kinds of cities are actually becoming prototypes of urban futures, not just in places like Mumbai, but all over the world. But the problem of viewing this kind of megacity as a theoretical landscape actually renders invisible some of the forms of participation in the urban economy and the community, such as the ones I think represented in this image. And correspondingly also the role of design in these kind of situations has been reduced to a tool of intervention. And a tool of intervention, moreover, that draws on the idiom of urban planning and the possibility that urban planning gives to itself of complete erasure and complete evasion of these sorts of evasive tactics, these constrained forms of escape, because these kinds of acts of fabrication are actually very much connected to the illegality of what rag pickers do, and because they are not recognized but tacitly recognized, they have this possibility of this constrained form of escape from visibility, from things that make them visible to the urban authorities. What I want to think about is, to actually and rather wonder aloud whether the role of design can be one of disruptive innovation and draw on its potential to be diagnostic and speculative as this, and thinking about these kinds of acts actually as being acts of infrastructure making rather than acts of evasion, and therefore acts which have to be then broken down and repaired, as it were.
Hi, everybody. I'm Judith Barry, and thanks for inviting me. I decided I would focus my remarks a little bit on what's happening today, Occupy Wall Street. And I also have a little clip from a project I just finished in Cairo about Cairo. And for the last 8 years, I've been interviewing women in all stratas of society in Cairo. And just as I was beginning to shoot this project, which is a series of as told to stories, in early January, the revolution started. And so as we were shooting, I was able to incorporate a couple of stories from the revolution directly into the project, which was sort of amazing. But as I shot here in New York with an Egyptian Arabic cast, we were constantly looking at Al Jazeera on our computers in between the breaks we were taking during the different shooting periods. I want to preface what I'm showing you in relationship to a couple of things. One, I was in 2003 when I began the project, Edward Said was still around, of course, and he was constantly going to the AUC in Cairo where I was located. And so the questions around Orientalism were still coming to the fore, and you all remember his formulation, so I won't repeat it here. But one of the things that he brought up, and this did have a direct effect on my project, was the fact that he really distrusted the visual, especially considering the title of his book, Orientalism. And he really privileged, because there was no voice for many people in the Arab world where you're constantly homogenized and all assumed to be the same, he really privileged the stories that other people might tell one another. And so over the course of this project, which was self-financed, which is why it took so long, I made many, many, many trips to Cairo, and I gradually penetrated through many stratas of the culture, starting from the AUC, which is the very privileged, and then working out to them through the barrios that ring the city of Cairo. So I'm going to play this clip, which is about a two-minute story from someone at the revolution. But the other point I wanted to make is somewhat in relationship to Occupy Wall Street. And in reading really quickly the, you know, just kind of not really reading but grazing and evading a lot of the text in the book, I was struck with how many of the texts in the book actually talk about the need to endlessly form something without resolving it into something. And Eduardo's text, which you mentioned a little earlier, was one of the texts that certainly does this. This need to keep things open-ended and continuously evolving also reminds me of many other, especially French writers and post-structuralist writers all through the last 25 years of post-modernity. And it seemed like in thinking about Occupy Wall Street, that maybe this is the moment that it's trickled down into the general population. Because what's very interesting to me about Occupy Wall Street at this particular moment is the fact that they haven't actually presented policy demands. They haven't made an agenda, which I think is very useful because as a movement, in that sense, it cannot be assumed to be a failure because it's endlessly, constantly evolving. And it also reminds me of Rosa Luxemburg's writing. And recently there was a couple of her writings, her recent collections of essays that just came out. And if you, probably all of you are familiar with her writing, but she was one of the first writers to really talk about the need for chaos during a revolution. And her, I would really, if you get a chance, you know, there, she was a great writer, as was Marx. And you, if you read those, you'll be really struck with how prescient they are for this particular moment. And I just wanted to say one thing to, about what V said, and I just wondered, but I'll maybe I should wait and show my clip first and then go back to her, or can I? I'll just ask you. One of the other people that I was very affected by in this project was Arjun Appadurai's work and his notion of the space that the imagination makes. And he talks about, especially within the poorer cultures, how people in telling one another stories can go from one place to another in their imaginations first, and how that then propels them using their imaginations into the real world or into kind of their real lives. And so I was struck by what you said about exactly the kind of some of the same districts when you were giving your notes. So I just wondered if you had read him or thought about him. Yeah, okay. All right.
When night comes in the square, suddenly everything feels very calm. As I walk around, I see men sleeping by the fires, trying to keep warm. They are sleeping under the tanks, on plastic, on blankets. But few women sleep. Most of them are keeping a wary eye out of the tents, being aware of their surroundings. Some are in the KFC taking care of the injured people. When I walk around the square, I hear bits of conversations, and I hear one man named Abdu, and I hear him say, "My vision goes much farther than what my eyes can see." Then I walk up to a group of women, and I hear one reading out loud from an interview with the famous novelist, Ehdef Suif, and I hear her, when she is quoted, saying, "Something beautiful is being born here. A nonviolent, grassroots, democratic movement that even in times of extreme crisis, promotes the ideas of public service, nonviolence, courtesy, and creativity." What can I say? This movement is not just Egyptian. It is for everyone in the world who believes in the idea that we can all live together in a better way. A 26-year-old protester named Muhammad ambles by, and I hear him say something like, "The words of the people are much stronger than any weapons." As I continue walking in the square, the dawn comes, and when this happens, you feel the life come back to the people in the square. The bloggers are all huddled together, busy typing away on their computers. You see the volunteers make cheese sandwiches and pass out tea to the people. And the pharmacists are even helping, and they're giving out Betadine to anybody who needs. Tahrir Square has become the capital of Cairo. It is funny because nobody wants to even give up a single moment that can be imbued by the idea of defiance. And yes, we may be wary, but when the morning comes, we will breathe freedom.
Hello. My name is Alexandra Wagner. I teach sociology at the New School and practice psychotherapy two blocks from Wall Street. So I was awakened at 2 o'clock this morning by sounds that did not allow for further sleeping for many different reasons. And a peculiar thought came to me. Who would be likely to be the patient that early in the morning? The pilot of the helicopter, or the young person just being evicted from the square? And as a response to that peculiar thought came, I believe the first sentence I heard when I started my studies in sociology here, and the statement was, we don't need more therapy, we need less capitalism. So I was trying to put that statement on a timeline, and it sounded like something that might have been produced in later 60s. And so I'd like to reflect on where I think, or to some degree know, the statement came, and then also where I think, or to some degree know, where it went on a kind of future-oriented scale. Helen Csikszentmihalyi said, one can escape only once. So I'd say that the radical, angry response to illusionary character of psychotherapy came, the response came to development that happened earlier in 40s and 50s in this country and produced the theory known as American ego psychology. And the myth or the story about its content is very much directed toward an adjustable ego, more than eager to engage in what is commonly known as pursuit of happiness. The peculiar story behind the theory is that it was a supposedly invention, creation, refinement produced by people who have, I'm not sure, escaped, evaded, or had to leave Europe to come here and continue their human and psychoanalytic lives. So it was that generation of, shall we call them refugees, shall we call them people in flight, shall we call them earlier generation of psychoanalysts that produced this thing, Europeans who produced American ego psychology that lived well nowhere but in the United States. So much for the adjustment of that particular kind, which is easy to discern, a bad adjustment. Moving 30 years into the future from that imaginary 1968 and very real one too, landscape of psychoanalytic theory in the United States, but not only here, is now known partly as relational psychoanalysis that has managed to export itself far better than American ego psychology and did one thing right, that is, never called itself American. At least I think, in my view, that was a good decision, to omit the place of origin. Now, to make that story as simple as the American ego psychology one, what the purpose, the change, and for some liberatory character of this new endeavor is that there may be a symmetry, but there is no hierarchy between the patient and the therapist, that there is exchange in terms of vulnerability, at least to some degree, and that ego is definitely not in the center of this particular story. So adjustment really does not come up as a part of critique. But I would like to therefore ask a question. To what degree and in what way our theories adjust themselves to our new moments rather than we ourselves? And what I would be interested in hearing more about from different positions of colleagues and all of you here is really either ordinary or extraordinary adjustments of theory, not of people, though of course they are bound to produce them, at least so I think.
Is this my turn, or yeah? Okay. I want to introduce myself. Then my name is Angel Jaramillo. I work here in CUNY for a new institution called the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect. And I hope that what I'm going to say is perhaps mysteriously related to our conversation. Let me try to explain what is the responsibility to protect as a concept. The idea of the responsibility to protect is an idea that was born as an alternative to what in the 80s and the 90s started to be called among political scientists and theorists of international relations humanitarian intervention. But the problem with the humanitarian intervention is that it was based upon the idea that there is a right of some kind of powers, be that the United Nations or NATO or the United States. It focuses so much on the right to intervene and not so much of the responsibility of the state to stop mass atrocities. So, I mean, the idea of the responsibility to protect was born as a way of how we collectively, I mean, the international community, should try to avert or prevent mass atrocities, like the kind of mass atrocities that took place in Rwanda or in Srebrenica, how we can collectively avert those mass atrocities. So the responsibility to protect didn't focus on the right of the powers to intervene, but on the responsibility of the state to stop these mass atrocities from taking place. I think this shift is a very important shift because part of the preoccupation of many was how we can convince countries that are likely or populations in which the states are likely to commit mass atrocities to support perhaps an intervention, an international intervention. And how we can convince these countries that sovereignty is not a license to kill. So according to R2P, to responsibility to protect, military intervention should be considered, but only as a last resort. That's another difference with humanitarian intervention. For R2P or responsibility to protect, what we have to do first is try to stop or prevent those mass atrocities through peaceful means. And if all that failed, then military intervention may be considered. So responsibility to protect is with us since 2008, and there are so many countries that have been intervened using this concept. For instance, in Kenya and in Guinea, some mass atrocities were prevented using the tool of the responsibility to protect. But now I would like to focus on the intervention in Libya, which is the last case in which this concept was used. The case of Libya was one in which a greater power, that I'm going to tell you what is my my interpretation of what happened. I think that, and I want to mention power because today it seems that power is the point of discussion. So the case of Libya was one in which a greater power, in this case, the international community or the United Nations or NATO, based upon an idea, a universal idea, that we all feel repulsion against the commission of mass atrocities, intervened, a larger power intervened to prevent a lesser power, in this case the Gaddafi regime, from wiping out civilians in Libya. What is important about the responsibility to protect, and I would like to emphasize, is the fact that for an intervention to be legitimate, it has to be legal. And legality, I mean, it's a problem with legality, but in this case, legality means that the Security Council of the United Nations approved the intervention. The problem with Iraq, for instance, was that it was not approved by the Security Council. And the problem of Kosovo was also a problem that the intervention was not approved by the Security Council. But the case of Libya, there was an approval, there was a resolution 1973, that mandated the international community to use all necessary means to protect civilians. Now, there was a great danger that had the international community not intervened to prevent Gaddafi to exterminate about 30,000 inhabitants of the city of Benghazi in a few days, a great genocide or something akin to genocide or a crime against humanity would be committed. And I think that, I mean, there are a lot of criticisms in the press, in the media, on the intervention. But I think that one of the gains of this intervention is that Benghazi is not going to join Rwanda, Srebrenica, Auschwitz as one of the graveyards of our moral conscience. So I think that intervention was very important in this sense. In terms of political philosophy, R2P, in my view, is a mixture of the Kantian idea of universal morality, the doctrine of just war, the idea that that international law matters, and the Nietzschean and Machiavellian idea that only power can stop other power. Only a big power can stop lesser power. So the issue that maybe we can discuss is how we can think about rationally, how we can think to identify what renders power legitimate and good, and what renders power tyrannical and bad. Because I think that power is a neutral concept for me. It depends how you use that power, and that power can be used for good, and power can be used for bad. I think maybe we can think about it today.
So I have two pictures on that laptop. Thank you. No, it's, I mean, I can pass it around. It's not. Okay. I have to open them up. I just have a very short thing to say, so it may not. Yes. So my name is Sarah Oppenheimer, and I came to this relatively recently and have been thinking about the complexity of the problem of evading power, and perhaps the evasion of power, and thinking that, in fact, to be evasive or to evade need not mean that you are avoiding or working against a condition of power. And in thinking that through, I was particularly interested and am particularly interested in the problem of time and how the control over time is in fact very much a exercise or a perhaps prerequisite of possessing power. So the instance that I selected or the images that I'm passing around is the piling up of garbage in the city of Napoli. Specifically, what interested me in that condition is that, for those, many of you are probably familiar with this, but that the garbage contracts for the city of Napoli are in fact largely or completely controlled by the Neapolitan Gomorra. And there has been then a perhaps a consolidation of power or perhaps a movement against existing power sources in specifically their refusal of those, the people who possess the contracts, to pick up the garbage, which then not only radically changes the fabric of the city, but also, in fact, shifts the entire structure of power within that urban fabric. And that was what I found interesting about that.
Well, while we are waiting, for those of you who have access to the internet, my name is Q Lee, K-Y-O-O-L-E-E. I mentioned that because I have an image uploaded on my website, if you want to go there, www.kyoolee.net. If you go there, that's the home page. On the upper right side, you will see the evasions of power. And click on that, and that's me. So, and I can also pass around this iPad for those of you who want to have a look. I mean, I have a couple of images that I like to use to just sort of illustrate what interests me in this concept, the evasions of power. So, to introduce myself just briefly, I teach philosophy and other powerful things at John Jay and at the Graduate Center as part of CUNY, both of them places. So justice is a pretty much is quite central to what I'm thinking about and what I write about. And I, in addition to philosophy, I teach justice studies at John Jay, which is the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, as some of you may know, and gender studies and so on. So the images that I've chosen. So when Catherine prompted us to think about the questions of specifically adjustment of power, can you hear me? Okay, all right. It was, so I started thinking about just in the adjustment, right? I have become naturalized thinker of justice because I'm adjusted to that institutional context. But also, it's kind of interesting, I haven't actually seen the Sisu's video until now, but I find it kind of interesting that that I myself actually started thinking about la vision, you know, the French word, but that I'm not even a French speaker, which is kind of funny. And I do read French. This is for professional reason. I'm trained in French philosophy. So when I thought about evasion, I immediately thought of this Levinas work, de la vision. So instead of thinking of evasiveness or just English evasion, I sort of immediately thought about that work. So much for the power of language, you know, what language actually you carry in you. And so, and when she talked about this Le Vision and as escape, this kind of interesting false friendship between escape and evasion there, that really resonated a lot with me as well. And I'll get to that images later on. And but before, in order for me to address some of the questions that I'd like to focus on in reference to those images, I do need to sort of cite this passage from Levinas, which was the first point of kind of a reading for me when I was thinking about adjustment and the Le Vision. I guess in the interest of saving time, maybe I should just begin with what I think will be the sort of the overriding thesis of my talk. I mean, I'm a philosopher, so I always sort of work with a proposition. What is the thesis of your idea? What interests me is this sort of idea that power generates itself by becoming immeasurable. That is the kind of idea that I think I ended up arriving at when thinking about a series of ideas around this notion of adjustment and power and evasion. Again, let me repeat that. So the idea here is this. Power keeps generating itself by becoming immeasurable. So it really sort of resonates also with what Judy was talking about, this sort of needing to keep yourself going and open-ended. And so, and let me just trace back, like, how and where I, you know, went to arrive that thought. So let me begin with the Levinas. So he's sort of writing this piece called the Le Vision, or, you know, as in light of his experience of escaping from this, you know, the massacre. Right? it's a very much sort of Holocaust survival kind of mode. He's talking about this escape, the need to survive. Right, and so that's where this notion of escape really comes from. So he's really talking about the certain auto adjustment of power in terms of the sheer need to survive. So what does it mean to exist? Right, and so it's almost like a power of life in a very literal sense. So let me just read that passage that really interests me in this context. Quote, "At the root of need, there is not a lack of being, but, on the contrary, a plenitude of being. Need is not oriented towards the complete fulfillment of a limited being, a certain towards satisfaction, but towards, rather, release and escape. Hence, to assume an infinite being that would have no need is contradictio in adagio." It's oxymoron, right? You cannot do that. This is interesting. Here he says, "The experience that reveals to us the presence of being as such, the pure existence of being, is an experience of its powerlessness, the source of all need." So what really interests me is just the last line, and the experience of powerlessness is the source of all need, and need simply to exist, right? And so that led me to really to think about this sort of the auto-generativity of power or auto-adjustment of power. And how does that happen and where does it come from? And so that led me to think about this sort of question of measure. I'm not sure how that really happened, but that sort of the measure really became a sort of thing that I thought I should look for. And in fact, as you can probably see from the images that I am circulating now, that actually led me back to the Daedalus and Kairos. And it's also interesting that Sisu also sort of mentioned that as almost an allegory of the condition for the possibility and impossibility of power, right? And so, as we can see, I also looked through some of the images and I looked at particularly the image that shows this sort of pointing, you know? So those two images that you see really seem to allegorize the kind of certain immeasurable indexicality of power and the power of measuring and also power of immeasure, right? And so again, as you know, the story of the Daedalus and Kairos is that, you know, in order to survive, the father had to use the son. It's kind of genealogical also kind of, you know, delay in order to extend the life. And so it's like, so in a sense, interesting, that passage shows how Daedalus was trapped in the labyrinth of his making. Simply, right? He was trapped in this labyrinth of his making, and he needed to escape. It's like this imprisonment, right? But the thing is that he made it himself. He's the god of invention, Angvineo, to come, right? And so in order to escape there, he had to put this wing, but not on himself, but on the next generation, the Icarus, the sun. So the idea here was that, so here we have like almost, like, you can give a sort of Freudian reading of that, you can give a sort of, you know, various readings of it, but I think you can give a literally a sartorial reading of it. Like you make him fit, right? It's like it fit, like you put his wing so that, you know, so he will be fit to fly, and then together, right? This kind of escape together, right? So it's very interesting, I thought, allegory, if you think about it. So there's a kind of sense of measure or measuring as an act, a sort of deliberation, consideration, trying to sort of invent something out as a way out of it. But now then the thing is that, you know, the concern was that, you know, he was instructing the sun, do not fly too far or low, right, above the sea, because you don't want to get too close to the sun, right? And the solar power basically melt the wax, and so they both died, right? They just plunge into the sea and then just die. So it's kind of interesting, I thought, the allegory of the measure. So it's like you're always risking your life or enabling yourself to live on by constantly measuring. And so there is a kind of measure. Sun as the immeasurability of power, you cross the line and you die, right? But you don't know where it is. Now, the other scene that I chose there is an interesting, so lesser-known kind of allegory as I think about it. As some of you may know, in the, I think it's late 19th century, so let me give you an exact period. Between 1880 and 1943, that is usually called, well, this in Asian American history, that's the era of the Chinese Exclusion Act. So that was the very first federal law, right, in the U.S., immigration law, that excluded certain individuals from becoming a member of the society, or they're just a legal citizen, on the basis of their ethnic origin. So hence Chinese exclusion law. And so during the time, some of the people from Asiatic origin, especially Chinese people, were trying to, you know, get in. And also, you know, this is a very complex, really fascinating story. And they're called the paper sons, because the only way they can get in to the country was to claim that they are the sons of a U.S. citizen of Chinese origin, right? And so you see that scene of the interrogation. So these are the people who are detained in Angel Island, San Francisco. So you have the Ellis Island in the East Coast, you have the Angel Island in the West Coast, right? But there isn't that symmetry, you know? If the Angel Island was the gate of blockage, right? You cannot come in. Everybody's interrogated there, whereas you have an image of the East Coast, Ellis Island, right? It's the port of welcoming. So you have the European, you know, you have images of European, you know, sort of people flooding in, and you have this whole kind of, you know, the come, you know, be part of us. Then, you know, on the West Coast, you have the Chinese people literally being blocked, and every case has to be examined. And so it's the kind of a Kafkaesque scenario where everybody has to prove that they are the sons of, you know, legal U.S. citizen. And so this is one case, just an image of that, it's a snapshot, it's very kind of famous within the Asian American history kind of, you know, narrative. What really interests me in that, if you just look at the image, is that I was really interested how the fingers are kind of evading the whole kind of scene, because you're talking, you're three people, like you have two interrogators, and then there's a Chinese man, China man, as it was called, right, are talking, and he's been interrogated. So all the details about him will have to verify that he is really the person that he claims he is, right? And so now, if you look at the finger, it's kind of, it's sort of, maybe they're fingerprinting, or I don't know what they're doing, but somehow it's pointing somewhere else. And I thought that's kind of interesting evasive practice, sort of, I mean, just in terms of visual allegory. And just give you an example of what kind of conversation is going on. Actually, I am working on this sort of the papers on issue as part of my project, in a research project, so I have some familiarity with that. And just, in the interest of saving time, again, just a really interesting kind of a snippet from a possible dialogue, and actually there's sort of some script from the interrogation. So an alleged husband is recalling a wedding, so he was forced to. So tell me about the wedding. So your husband, you know, well, your husband, your wife, and so what happened? So they have like this original paper, and then they're trying to match whether he actually verifies that. So the questioner is saying, well, the stripes that was part of the veil of the bride, was it quite broad or otherwise? And what is the answer? Not too wide. Right? And that is really interesting. And so there's a kind of a, it's not an answer, but, you know, still an answer, not too wide. I mean, so there's a kind of, you know, sort of, that's kind of what I meant by kind of immeasurability of power. It's like actually he is empowering himself through this sort of evasive narrative. But that is part of what? This process of identifying himself as the person, that's just acts of fabrication that you're talking about, right? It's a very interesting kind of microscopic, micrological levels of this sort of adjustment to power, right? As a source for life and death. This is kind of a biopolitical concept as well. I just thought that, you know, just to juxtapose, also it's a question of paper science. It's about the generational survival, right? So you have this generation of people wanting to survive in particular areas, and so how do you actually keep it going through generation lines as well? So Daedalus and Kairos is an ancient Greek example, and you have the 19th century, 20th century, you know, Asian American example. I see that very interesting. Also, I mean, now we have the psychiatrist in presence. This is a kind of Freudian reading. This is very interesting too. But I mean, I have a lot of sort of thoughts about how this can be read, but I just wanted to focus also on the question of measure, the immeasurability of that, almost the force of life or the power of life, right? And so how power does and should just keep going, right? And the whole, you know, the sense of scale, you know, the time scale that you talked about this too, but so how the theory should adjust itself to that, and all this question seems really kind of fascinating. Also, when I think about what I prepared and what just we've been talking about so far, is very rich. I mean, not mine, but I mean, you know, just all the conversations that we've been having so far. So I hope that was kind of interesting or curious, at least some kind of anecdote that you can think around. And so... And thank you also, Catherine, and Aaron for inviting, you know, me to this, to give my little bit of a allegory here. Okay, thank you.
I'm Stephen Zaks, a reporter on public art, architecture, and urbanism. And I didn't prepare anything. I thought that I would just come and observe, really, but I'm grateful for the opportunity to participate. Maybe I would just make a few comments based on some of the things that were discussed already. Catherine, you started off talking about this concept of adjustment as it would have been regarded by Adorno, which was maybe something that I'm willing to respond to in some way, as I've often taken issue with the premise of negativity as a tool of productive. I take for granted that the premise of an evasion of power is some effort towards social justice or something like that. It's kind of an unstated assumption, I guess. I guess then the question for me is, I guess when I was younger, I took for granted that resistance to power was going to be the main way that the tool of social justice or transformation. And not to say that I'm completely past that concept, but I started to think at a certain moment that what if I applied myself to trying to understand the way that power worked in order to potentially have power, in order to potentially understand systems enough to insert myself into them. And maybe this resembles in some way the way that Foucault would have talked about a kind of insertion into a system as in finding small means of modes of resistance within an oppressive system or something. But I want to be more affirmative about it, actually, and say that I think that that it's possible for whether an artist or financier or even a architect to have that as a goal, as being an affirmative creator of a possessor of power, someone who, for instance, even within the system of neoliberalism, which is normally decried by leftist people, and someone like Teddy Cruz will say, I wouldn't even want to participate in it if it helped people. In some circumstance, I've heard him say that. What if you if you had as your premise that you were trying to actually make a practical improvement of some discrete situation? So I think if I were going to talk about particular projects that I've been trying to get involved in, they've been focused on that, looking for ways that I could potentially be of service and use whatever knowledge that I have to contribute to communities or to shift capital, shift knowledge into places where it could potentially be of use. So that's my kind of contrarian contribution question about, to what extent evasion is necessary. I was just reading David Harvey, trying to catch up on his analysis of neoliberalism, and really was fascinated by a couple of points, that one of which resonates a lot with what Tom Frank wrote probably 15 years ago about the way that dissent had been commodified during the sort of era of the 60s counterculture and turned into a tool of capitalist production. He talks about that in a sort of different way, and then describes the way that during the period of this transformation of the New York economy into an incredibly powerful financial system, it also gave birth to this postmodern free artistic culture that was incredibly premised on ideas of resistance and anti-authoritarianism. And so I want to suggest that maybe the concepts of evasion are essentially the same or parallel to capitalist processes of exchange. So I don't know. Maybe I'll just send it back to you to discuss.